Dr. Chris Forbes, who's here, is a senior lecturer in ancient history, and he's deputy chairman of the Society for the Study of Early Christianity. And the title of his lecture tonight is The Laws of Nature, the Ancient Origins of a Modern Scientific Puzzle, and its Relationship to Christianity. So, Chris, thank you very much for coming to speak to us.
And thank you to two Peters, in this case, Peter who's just spoken and Peter Ireland. Peter for bringing me and introducing me, and Peter Ireland for harassing me until I realised I was coming. However, when I was at high school, I really, really wanted to be a physicist. I was deeply fascinated by relativity, by astrophysics, by all the rocket science ends of things. But it became very clear to me in year 11 and 12 that I was never going to be a fluent speaker of mathematics. And that really cuts you out of the physics end of business fairly quickly. But I've kept a long-term interest in the concepts of cosmology and physics. But I've ended up completely differently as an ancient historian, and as Peter said, specialising in New Testament history, but with a broad interest in the intellectual context of the world of the New Testament. So I'm sorry to say that speaking for the Institute for the Study of Christianity in an Age of Science and Technology, I am neither a scientist nor a theologian. So you may begin to wonder why you invited me. I hope that the reason it may be worthwhile to talk about this subject is that our modern Western culture is largely the product of two great traditions of thought. It's a product of the biblical tradition of thought and of the Greco-Roman tradition of thought, and our scientific tradition in particular has its roots in Greek philosophy. And it's those roots that I want to start with exploring tonight in this whole discussion of the idea of the laws of nature. What I want to do, in essence, is raise puzzles about this concept that nature has laws, ask what this concept might mean, to what extent it's simply a metaphor, to what extent we might mean it seriously, and what Christians think about it. And I want to begin with the beginnings of the Greek intellectual tradition, with the poems of Homer, the Iliad and the Odyssey, and the dramatic vision of a world in which gods take part in events with human beings all the time. Now, in the world of the Homeric poems, which form the basis for everybody's education in the Greek and Roman world, the first things you read, the first stories you heard were from Homer. This was in the background of every educated person's mind. From the beginnings of literacy right down into the Roman world, it was quite clear in the poems of Homer that the world was run by the will of Zeus and by those who could persuade Zeus to their point of view. When Zeus formally nods his head and says, "This will happen," then it does, and nothing will change it. Now, Zeus cannot control everything. Fate also has a part, and fate is more powerful than the gods in certain important ways. But when the father of gods and men, Zeus himself, formally nods his head in decision, that's that. Done deal. In the Iliad, book one, Achilles' mother, a nymph, Thetis, begs Zeus for a boon that while Achilles hold back from fighting for the Greeks, the Trojans will have the upper hand. And Zeus says, and I quote, "I'll take care of this. And so you can have some peace of mind, I'll say yes to you by nodding my head. The ultimate pledge, unambiguous, irreversible, absolutely fulfilled. Whatever I say yes to with a nod of my head." And the son of Cronus, that's Zeus, nodded. Black brows lowered, a glory of hair cascaded down from the Lord's immortal head, and holy Olympus trembled. That was the way things worked in the view of Homer and the ordinary educated Greek person. The will of God determined events. Mind you, if you tugged at God's sleeve a bit, you might get him to make up his mind your way. Kings made laws. Great men made rulings. The universe was like that as well. Zeus made the rulings. The universe was like a human society. It was a bit unpredictable. But some things, authoritative decisions by Zeus, were reliable. Oh, there was also the power of fate, and that was impersonal. But that was the way the ordinary Greek thought the world was. The world was run a little bit the way a large patriarchal family was run, by one dominant authority who everybody else pulled at the sleeve at to see if they could get events to go their way. That was the way things were. But around about 560 BC, a different view began to emerge. A very different view. And it's first formulated for us by Anaximander in the earliest known statement from Greek philosophy. Now, just very briefly, I'm going to interrupt myself here and say, my apologies. I do not have PowerPoint for you here today. I do have PowerPoint for about half of my lectures in general, but something happened this morning which distracted me mightily for a full 2 hours, just in the peak, I've got to produce the PowerPoint now, period of my life. And so there isn't a PowerPoint, and I'm justifying this on the basis that we are not worshippers of images. We are followers of the word, and I'm hoping you'll put up with it and apologise in those terms. I have a biblical quote, or in this case, misquote, to justify my position, which is not by Microsoft, not by PowerPoint, but by my spirit, says the Lord God of hosts. However, that's just to explain that this will be a verbal lecture rather than one for which you need PowerPoint, but there will be an outline, a structured outline of it available on the website shortly, once I know what to include in the structured outline. Okay, as I said, about 560 BC, a different view of the nature of the universe began to be formulated, and the earliest known sentence, a direct quotation of a Greek philosopher, is attributed to Anaximander, and I'm going to read it to you, and you're not going to understand it, because it's dense and a bit poetic, and a bit hard to make sense of, and then I'm going to explain it. According to Simplicius, writing in the 6th century AD, more than 1,000 years after this comment was originally written, Anaximander had said, and I quote, "The original sources of existing things are also what existing things die back into," and here comes the quote, "according to necessity. They give justice and reparation to one another for their injustice in accordance with the ordinance of time," end quote, and Simplicius says, as Anaximander puts it in somewhat poetic terms. Now, I did warn you, you wouldn't understand it. Let me take the quote and say a little bit about what it actually says and what it probably means. Simplicius says it means the original sources of existing things. Notice, we're already in a world where terminology is starting to be important. Sources of things, existing things, are also what existing things die back into. So things that exist come from somewhere and die back into the same thing. Then comes the quote from Anaximander, "according to necessity, for they give justice and reparation to one another for their injustice in accordance with the ordinances of time." What Anaximander seemed to be saying is something like this. This is a modern analogy. We all know that electricity is something that exists in our world. Even though you can't see it, you can see its effects. If you're so foolish as to put your finger too near an electrical contact, you can feel the effects, though usually only for a brief period. And we know that the universe in general is what you might describe as electrically neutral. It all kind of balances out. But out of this neutrality, you can get a positive charge, a negative charge, and if they're close enough to affect each other, you can get a current that flows, and when the current flows, the positive charge and the negative charge cancel each other out. We all understand in broad general terms that this is the way electricity works, and then there's DC and then there's AC, and we don't need to get into the technicalities. But the point is, the universe is electrically neutral, but out of this neutrality, it is possible to get action. You can get a positive and a negative and a flow, and then they kind of cancel out and you're back to neutral again. Now, I think Anaximander is saying something like that. He's saying that the universe is kind of a neutrality out of which opposites can be generated, but, and I'm going back to the quote, they give justice and reparation to one another for their injustice in accordance with the ordinance of time. In other words, they cancel each other out again and go back into neutrality. If you like, we can go to another scientific concept, though it's one more familiar in science fiction than in the world of science fact, though it is science fact, and that's the notion that there is in our universe both matter and antimatter. And let's not go to dark matter, because we're fairly well agreed that we don't know what that is yet. But there's matter and there's antimatter. But if you put them together, there's an enormous flash of energy, and then you've got, well, kind of nothing. They've gone. They've cancelled each other out. And Anaximander seems to be saying that's the way it is with hot and cold. That's the way it is with light and heavy. That's the way it is with light and dark in our world. They come out of a kind of neutral background, they appear for a while, and then they go away again, cancelling each other out. But notice the metaphor he uses. They give justice and reparation to one another for their injustice. It's almost as if, by seizing the spotlight for a period, appearing in the world, in the stage of the world's events, things have done something unjust and they've got to pay back the time they've given by returning to neutrality. Now, he says that this is a matter of justice and necessity. And what he seems to mean is, it's a rule. It's like a law. There's a law that governs the way the universe works. Now that, as far as I know, is the first implicit use of the concept of natural law in the Western tradition, and it's right at the very roots of Greek philosophy. And the important thing to notice is the shift from a mythological worldview which says that the world happens the way it does because of gods that are like people, authoritative figures, to a metaphor that says the world is like a human society which makes laws and enforces them. We've gone from a mythological metaphor to a social metaphor. Now we don't say Zeus does it, now we say there are laws of nature, just the way there are laws of society. And this idea then became so standard in the Greek intellectual tradition, though it took many different forms, that it stopped being a metaphor and began to be taken as a literal description. There really were laws of nature. And that's where I want to stop for the first moment and ask, but is it a literal description, or is it actually just a metaphor? Are we actually saying the universe is like a human society which makes rules and then enforces them? How does the analogy work? Who makes the laws? What enforces them? How does this go? Or is it just a matter that there are regular occurrences in the world which we metaphorically describe as the world obeying laws, but it is only a metaphor? How do we think about this? Now, going back to the mainstream, because you can't stop a historian doing things chronologically. You can stop them briefly for a minute or two with a digression, but that's a different matter. the idea that there were rational, comprehensible laws to the way the universe worked was developed most early by the great philosopher Heraclitus of Ephesus around about 500 BC, perhaps two generations after Anaximander, in his interpretation of the world. Heraclitus was deeply concerned with the nature of change, and most of us know the jokes about this. We've all heard the joke about George Washington's axe. It had had four or five new heads and several new handles, but it was still a good axe. It had changed in absolutely complete fashion over time, but it was still a good axe. In what sense was it the same axe? Clearly it wasn't. Heraclitus was very interested in this whole question of the nature of change, and in our own human bodies, this is an issue which we take for granted and don't really think about most of the time. Over a period of between, I believe, some of the biological scientists here may be able to refine or correct me on this point, but over a period of, I believe, between 5 and 7 years, every single cell in your body dies and is replaced. And you don't notice. Because you, whatever it is you are, still feels the same. But is it still the same you? Change is an odd business. You can change and not know you've changed. Heraclitus was deeply interested in this whole process, and two of his most famous sayings will illustrate this point. Perhaps his most famous saying was simply two words in Greek, panta rei, everything flows. Or if you prefer, everything is in a state of flux. Everything is constantly changing. And his most famous saying of all is the so-called river saying of Heraclitus. And it's the saying, no man can step in the same river twice. Now, it's a deliberate paradox. Heraclitus loved paradox. And what it essentially means is, a river is not a thing. A river is a process. A river is a flow. Everything flows. A river is a flow of water. And if you step into it, step back, and step into it again, it's different water. It's not the same river at all. Because a river isn't an object. A river is a process. Heraclitus was deeply interested in this whole approach, and argued that the whole natural world was a complex set of processes of change going on all the time, and it wasn't so much a matter that there were things in the world, elements, stuff, substances. What mattered about the world was that there were processes going on constantly, like rivers. Clouds. What sort of an object is a cloud? From down here, you look up at the sky and you see it looks solid. Go up in a plane and you discover the edges of the cloud are not solid at all. They're fuzzy. A cloud isn't actually an object. A cloud is a complex process of condensation and evaporation going on, changing at the edges. Clouds don't move. I know they look like they move. But what happens is they evaporate at one end and condense at the other, and the thing we think looks like a cloud moves. But it's actually different water molecules over time. There's another interesting case of this change business. And the problem that taking the puzzle of change seriously raises is that it makes knowing things extremely difficult. If everything is constantly changing, then human knowledge is really difficult. Because what you know today may not be true tomorrow, because you don't know what may have changed. So Heraclitus struggled with the question, how can human knowledge be possible if I am correct that the universe is constantly in a state of flux? What do I know? For that matter, how do I know that everything is in a state of flux? How can I know that with any certainty? But and this was Heraclitus' solution to the problem, change is itself a constant. There are patterns in the change, and paradoxically, those patterns don't change. Those patterns of change are what is reliable, consistent, and knowable. In all the chaos of everyday experience, there are underlying principles which can be deduced, and according to the first known fragment of Heraclitus' work, everything happens according to the Logos. Now, Logos is a perfectly ordinary Greek word which can mean speech, it can mean written discourse, it can mean rational thought, it can mean all those things in different contexts. And yes, it is the word that ends up in John's Gospel, chapter 1, when John says, "In the beginning was the Word, the Logos, and the Logos was with God, and the Logos was God." That's a word that had been in use when John wrote it for more than 500, maybe 600 years as a technical philosophical term. I don't think John knew that, by the way. But he's using a word with a long history. And the important point about this word is that for Heraclitus, what Heraclitus was saying is, you can't rely on the things in the world to stay the same and stay knowable, but you can rely on the Logos, the underlying rational principles, the rules that describe the way things change. Now there, though he's not using the language, is the concept that in a world of constant change and flux, there are rules, there are laws, and they are what make the world knowable. The weather isn't reliable, but barometric pressure, that you can study. Patterns of wind flow, currents, those you can study. Patterns of change, they are statistically analysable. Now, these ideas that there was something you could describe as the laws of nature developed and became part of the wider Western intellectual tradition in two forms. There are two ways. And the first is the idea that there might exist what we call natural law in the realm of ethics. And it applies where there are rules that virtually any culture is likely to subscribe to, and you call those laws of nature in an ethical way. These are not just cultural norms, these are reliable rules that virtually all cultures would agree on. But for Heraclitus, there seems to be an implication that this is also true of the natural world. And notice, for Heraclitus, the rules are not a property of matter. The rules apply to matter, but they do so from outside. It's not as if the world is a billiard table and you can study the geometry of the way the billiard balls connect, collide, bounce away, and it's easy to calculate, because it's all to do with the properties of billiard balls. No, Heraclitus is saying it's not properties of matter. There are rules that are outside the physical realm, but which make the physical realm do what it does. Societies in the Greek world were no longer regulated by great kings whose word was law. Societies in the Greek world were now regulated by city-states that made their own rules. Societies are regulated by laws. Maybe the physical world is regulated by laws as well. And this idea has become such a commonplace, it's been imported holus bolus into Christian popular culture. And the great Victorians sang the hymn, probably written by Edward Osler in 1836, and you know the words. Praise the Lord, for he has spoken, worlds his mighty voice obeyed, laws that never shall be broken, for their guidance he has made. Now the question I'm asking is not, is this a good hymn, because I think it's widely agreed that it's a great hymn, but the question is simply, is it true? Is that the way it works? That God is the one who makes the rules and the one who enforces them? We were taught, I hope you were all taught, Newton's laws in school science. But I hope you were also taught that Einstein's theory means that Newton's laws are in fact not laws. They're only approximations. They work most of the time at the local level, but when you get to the very big or the very small, the realm of the quantum or the realm of the cosmos, Newton's laws are only a rough approximation, and Einstein does much, much better and may even be right. But that's what we thought about Newton. It raises the question whether scientists really know what the laws of nature are, or indeed whether the concept of the laws of nature is right after all. Any society that has laws necessarily has a process for making laws and another process for enforcing laws. If nature has laws, who made them? And what enforces them? Perhaps nature only has regularities or patterns. Perhaps law is not the right way to think about it. What I'll try to show for the rest of this lecture is that various of the views that modern scientists and cosmologists hold on this topic were also held, or at the very least prefigured, by ancient philosophers in the Greek and Roman world. Not all, I have to say. I don't think that the ancients ever got close to relativity or string theory. But that will lead to the question whether it is still meaningful to talk about the laws of nature the way we normally do. What might the laws of nature be? They might be outside realities that work on the physical world we know, and they might be imposed by a creator. That is what Plato thought, for example. Plato thought that the creator made the world using certain kinds of matter, but the types of matter the creator had available to him meant that there were limits on what the creator could do. It was not possible for the creator to make everything exactly the way he wanted to, because he had to make it out of stuff. And the stuff had properties that couldn't be changed. So one of the questions I'd like to ask you at a Christian level, though I'm not expecting an easy or a quick answer, is, are there realities that even God cannot change? Is God stuck with certain things simply because that's the way they are? Just to push the question to an extreme limit, is it possible for God to make a circle with corners? Or is that just silly? Well, the common one that's used more commonly is it possible for God to make a stone so heavy he can't lift it? Because if he can, then he can't lift it. Makes omnipotence a difficult concept. How far are we going to push this? Are we going to argue that there are limitations on God? Or are we going to say there are no limitations on God, except possibly the limitations of logic? Ooh, that's interesting. So logic is prior to God. I don't know whether I want that to be true. Maybe logic proceeds from the nature of God. Oh, that feels better theologically, at least to my untrained theological mind. Wonder how you feel about it. So for Plato, the laws of nature might be imposed on matter by the creator, but there were limits as to what the creator could do. Not everything in the world is perfect, not the way the creator wanted. The great early Christian thinker, St. Augustine, argued, no, God not only created the universe, he created the matter out of nothing, with no pre-existent qualities built into it that he couldn't change, and he created the laws under which it all operates, and he created both of them in the one act of creation, the world and the rules by which the world works. And this has important theological connotations, because it changes what we mean by the idea of miracle altogether. If we work with an idea of laws of nature, then we tend to work with the concept that what a miracle is when God breaks the laws of nature, or suspends them, or something like that. And something that would not normally happen does, and we say, ha, miracle. Augustine thought that was an incoherent concept. because God made the rules of nature. He would therefore not break them. He would make them such that miracles happened when he wanted them to happen, because the rules were built in. God would not make rules that he would then have to break. That would be inept. He would make rules that worked and occasionally threw up a miracle. So there's a very different concept of miracle. Or the laws of nature might be impersonally imposed upon the universe by some other principle or higher reality, not a god, but something else, like the nature of things. Or the laws of nature might just be properties of matter, properties of the arrangements of matter, with no god necessary. We tend to think this way. We tend to think about the universe working because different atoms have different electromagnetic and nuclear properties, and the way they interact is built into them, and that's just the way the universe is. Or we might think that the rules of nature are properties of matter and its arrangement, understood pantheistically in some sense, that this is what God does with the matter that he is engaged with. Those are all possibilities of ways of thinking. Now, the next big development that I want to point to happened about three generations after Heraclitus and his idea of the Logos. And this was with the famous Greek philosopher and poet Empedocles, and this is the man who almost everyone knows a little bit about, because almost everyone knows that in the ancient world people believed that there were four basic elements. There was earth, air, fire and water. Those four elements made up everything else. But that is not the only thing that Empedocles believed. Empedocles believed the universe was the way it was because of a combination of those four elements blending in different proportions to make everything. And he used the wonderful metaphor that artists only need, in the Greek way of thinking, four primary colours to paint a picture of anything. So maybe anything is made up of four primary elements, earth, air, fire and water, just mixed properly. Lovely analogy that works really quite well if you think there are four primary colours. But Empedocles also believed that there were two forces at work, and he called those two forces love and strife. And he personified them poetically as gods and goddesses in his poetry. But what he had done, you see, is something that modern physics absolutely depends on. He'd said that the world was made up both of matter and of forces that act on matter, which are not the same thing as matter. But Empedocles was a great thinker for multiple reasons, because he is the first one that we know of to raise the question, do the rules that govern the universe work everywhere or only here? And at the most basic level, he did this because for the ancient Greeks it seemed quite apparent that there were two completely different sets of rules running the universe. There were the rules that worked down here, and there were the rules that worked up there, in the heavens. Because, down here, it was widely agreed that anything you dropped would fall in the direction commonly known as down. And if you pushed things, they moved in straight lines, unless you pushed them several times, in which case they formed corners and did curves and that sort of thing. But the point was, down here, things move in straight lines, unless something makes them do otherwise. But up in the heavens, that doesn't seem to work, because things up in the heavens go round. Can we come up with one set of rules that will explain both? Empedocles thought you could. And he argued, brilliant conjecture, that the universe is like a kind of enormous twister, a spiral. And down here, matter has settled out of the spiral at the bottom and falls towards the bottom and moves in straight lines, whereas up there in the heavens, where it's still spinning, it goes around in circles, but the one basic rule makes it work both up here and down here. Now that's a brilliant piece of conceptual logic. He's saying, I can come up with a theory that explains two apparently completely different realms, where movement is completely different, but in fact there is one rule that drives the whole thing. And all you need is a willy-willy. All you need is a vortex. All you need is a spiral. All you need to do is to take a drink and stir it and see what's happening. And you've got a concept for explaining the way the world works. Now, in the next 100 years or so, along came one of the greatest intellectual breakthroughs of the ancient world. And this is the breakthrough that we associate with the name of Pythagoras and the Pythagoreans. Now, we have fundamental problems historically knowing about the Pythagoras, the historical person. For among other things, the Pythagoreans swore an oath never to write down the master's teaching and only to pass them on by word of mouth. As a result, the written evidence we have about Pythagoras is pretty skimpy. This is a pain, so I'm not going to talk about Pythagoras very much. I will say one thing about him because it's the one thing everybody knows, and what I'll say is more about the Pythagoreans who followed him. Almost everybody knows one thing about Pythagoras, the theorem. Draw a triangle. 3 units on one side, 4 units on one side, right angle, and the other side will be 5 units. 3, 4, 5 triangles. And they're utterly reliable. A 3, 4, 5 triangle will make a right angle every time. Always. Now, the Egyptians had known this for more than 2,500 years. They'd been building pyramids that way. That's how you lay out a nice square corner on your pyramid. But it was a Greek, and we do not even know which one, who realized that this was a mathematical, geometrical, theoretical truth, even if nobody on earth ever tied knots in a piece of string. 3, 4, 5 triangles were true in the abstract. Now that's conceptual thinking of a very high order, to realise that something might be true in theory, quite regardless of whether anyone ever puts it into practice. The Pythagoreans realised how many things in everyday life mathematics applied to, geometry applied to. They realised, for example, that the musical intervals, octaves, thirds, fourths, fifths, corresponded precisely to certain ratios of the length of the string you were plucking. And this was true no matter what the string was made of, no matter how tight it was pulled, the ratio was constant. If you took a string and plucked it, and then halved it and plucked it again, you got the note, the octave higher, every time. Then there are ratios of 3/5, ratios of 4/5, that give you different musical intervals, and it always works. And some brilliant Pythagorean mathematician said to themselves, there's a rule here that applies, and it doesn't just apply to music. It applies in the abstract. It applies in theory. It's true whether anyone ever plays a musical instrument or not. Then they applied it to astronomy. And though they were wrong, given the astronomy they knew, they were able to argue that the distances that matched the musical intervals were also the distances from the Earth out to the Moon and the planets. And from this came the extraordinary insight on which all of modern physics is based. That mathematics runs the way the universe works in some way that we do not understand. Maths is related to reality. Maths is the rules. Maths is the language on which the universe runs. Now, whether they are right or not is a very, very complex question to answer philosophically. But what a staggering insight to come to, that mathematics might be the language on which... There's another one of those metaphors. Did you hear me do that? Metaphors might be the language that the universe speaks. What do I mean? What's the claim actually being made? Now, later Pythagoreans extended this into geometry and began to get really interested in the nature of geometrical truth more broadly. And along came then the atomist theories, completely different from the Pythagoreans. People like Democritus, and most people have heard of the origins of the atomic theory among the Greeks. And Democritus was on a completely different path. He was arguing that the universe is made up of two things only: atoms and empty space. Atoms and void. And everything else in the universe is simply a matter of the properties of those atoms and how they interact with each other. And he made it very clear that he was a serious scientific reductionist when he formulated it this way. By convention, people say things are hot or cold. By convention, people say things are light or heavy. But in reality, there is atoms and void. And that's it. All the rest is just conventional language. Reality, reductionistically speaking, is nothing but atoms of particular shapes and sizes bouncing off each other or bouncing against other things and not bouncing off each other, perhaps locking on to one another. That's all that there really is in the world. Now, these different threads of Greek intellectual theory, you will notice, are beginning to correspond to different parts of the way modern people think about physics as well. Because we're pretty keen on atomic theory, though really in a rather different way than the Greeks. And we're pretty keen on the mathematical aspects as well. Let me take you one or two notches further and then begin to draw things together into a kind of a conceptual framework. We come to the greatest and most famous of the ancient philosophers, Plato. According to later traditions, over the entrance to Plato's academy was a sign which said, "Let no one ignorant of geometry enter here." Now, most Greek shrines said something like, "Let no one who is unfair or unjust enter here." You had to be a good person. Plato said, "I want you to study geometry first." Why? Because geometry is one of those fields that the Greeks were onto where things are true in theory and things can be proven demonstratively, not just empirically using statistics to a certain level of probability. Things can be proven beyond sensible doubt. If you know about 3, 4, 5 triangles, you know they don't change. Well, they change size, but they remain utterly reliable. And Plato developed a complex geometry which was a kind of blend of Pythagorean geometry and atomic theory. But here's something that may take you a little bit of getting your head around. Instead of arguing that the minimal things in the universe were little lumps of stuff, atoms, Plato said, no, there's something more basic and fundamental than little bits and lumps of stuff. There are points, lines, plane surfaces, and shapes. And they are more basic, they are more fundamental than three-dimensional things. Think about it. What's the simplest two-dimensional object you can have? Answer, a triangle. Because if you have three lines that intersect, you get a triangle. Whereas if you get two lines that intersect, all you've got is two lines that intersect. Doesn't go anywhere, doesn't do anything. But three lines that intersect can give you a triangle. And there are three types of triangles. There are equilateral triangles where the sides are identical. There are isosceles triangles where two of the sides are identical but one isn't. And there are scalene triangles where they're all different, and the right angled 3-4-5 triangles are one of those. And Plato said, anything you can make out of triangles, because the simplest possible three-dimensional shape is a tetrahedron, which is made up of four equilateral triangles. Then there's a cube, which is made up of six squares, each square of which is two triangles. And there's octahedrons, and there's dodecahedrons, and there's all the other famous Platonic solids. And they're all made out of triangles. And now link that in with Empedocles' four elements, and Plato hypothesizes that fire is made up of tetrahedrons, and each of the elements is one other basic geometric solid shape. And what you've got here is an intellectual synthesis that is trying to put together the ideas of atomic theory, the ideas of geometry, and the idea of fundamental elements of nature, and make a consistent theory with all of these involved. Now, I've only got two or three more points to make to show you the way all of this leads us to the question we have about the laws of nature. Because what I'm asking is essentially, if we believe there are laws of nature, what kind of things are they? What are the roots of the laws of nature that make them go? Is it basic geometry? Is it properties of matter? Is it rules imposed from outside? Is it mathematical? How are we thinking about this? And we've gone from a mythological view that says the world works the way it does because a god says so, to a world based on a social analogy that says the world works the way it does because there are laws. And people keep coming up with analogies to answer the question, why does the world work the way it works? The great Stoic philosophers, for example, stuck with the four elements, earth, air, fire and water. But they were pantheists, and they argued that the universe was identical with God. The physical universe was God's body. God's mind was the soul of the universe. And the universe works the way it does because built into God is logos, rationality, reasonability, logic. And God thinks and the world happens. It's his body just the way you think, and your body gets up and walks and does things, because it works according to the rules of your mind. The universe is like that. And notice what they've done. They've come up with a complex analogy that says the universe works like what? Like an organism. And what I actually want to be suggesting to you here is that what people are doing is they are regularly coming up with analogies for the way the universe is based on the most complex thing they can think of. For the mythological Greeks, how does the world work? It works like a large complex human society run by a patriarch. For the people who believe in laws of nature, it runs like a large complex human society making and enforcing its own rules. For the Stoics, it works like a complex organism. Now skip more than 1,000 years and you get down to the period when human beings are starting to make clocks and complex mechanical mechanisms, and guess what they say? The universe runs like a complex machine. The universe is like a giant piece of clockwork. We keep pulling these metaphors out of our own understandings of things that aren't the whole universe and saying maybe that's the way the universe works. It's like one of those, which is currently the most complicated thing we can think of. But the great Sir Isaac Newton, for example, argued for his theological position on the laws of nature, that God did not interfere in the world. What God did was take the enormous clockwork of the universe, wind it up, and let it run according to its own built-in internal rules. And I suppose in theory God could stick his finger into the mechanism and change things, but he wouldn't. And that's what made Newton a deist. God winds up the mechanism and then doesn't interfere. Now you come down to the Victorian era and science is coming into its own and the concept of the laws of nature is coming into its own, because scientists are more and more discovering the absolute regularities of nature and the way it is absolutely reliable nearly all of the time. Scientists know what this is. This is the rule of reliability. Experiments must all fail the same way. Sorry, that was a joke. Replicability. The rules have got to apply time after time after time after time to be sure that there is a rule. And so strong did this concept become in the Victorian mind that the great German philosopher and political scientist Karl Marx talked about there being laws of society's development like laws of nature. And if you read Marx, he actually believes, and this is why Marxists were so strong on this, that human society develops in predictable ways, the way science is predictable. And in fact, history is driven with, and I quote, the iron necessity of a law of nature. Now that's a fascinating way to think of the world. The iron necessity of the laws of nature. What makes them laws? Answer? You don't have to know. They are. It works. We rely on it day by day. We do. The lights are still on. Electricity seems to be thoroughly there are blackouts occasionally, but we know what causes them. There are laws. The Gaia hypothesis that was developed perhaps 20 or 30 years ago argued that the Earth as an ecosystem was like one enormous organism. And mythologically we can name it after Gaia, the old pagan goddess of the Earth, because that's a useful way of summing up the hypothesis. But again, what we are doing as human beings is thinking by applying analogies from one realm into another realm and hoping, like anything, that it works. The question I want to sum up what I'm saying with is the question raised by Stephen Hawking, no less, in chapter 12 of his famous book, perhaps one of the most purchased and not read books in the history of publishing, A Brief History of Time, where Hawking says, we know what the equations are that govern the universe. We know what the rules are, or at least we know a lot of them. It is just a set of rules and equations. But here's the question. What is it that breathes fire into the equations and makes a universe for them to describe? There's matter and there's the rules. That concept is as old as Empedocles, maybe as old as Anaximander. And somehow, the two of them together make a world. And Hawking goes on. The usual approach of science of constructing a mathematical model cannot answer the question of why there should be a universe for the model to describe. Why does the universe go to all the bother of existing? And he seems to be saying, that's a question science really can't answer, because science doesn't have the methods to answer it. So here's my question. Is the world like a clan of anthropomorphic gods? And it happens the way it does because the boss god says so? Or is the world like a well-run society which has laws that are enforced? And if so, who made them and what enforces them? Is the world something that runs mathematically? It certainly seems to a lot of the time. Or is the world just like an enormous 3D billiard table where atoms bounce off each other or occasionally crack one another if they come fast enough? Is the world like a living organism? Or is the world like a giant clockwork mechanism? Or, and this is the most recent one, about 15 years ago, a physicist published an article arguing that the world is actually like a computer. Oh, hang on, we're doing it again. We're just thinking of the most complex thing we've come up with recently and saying, maybe that's the way the world works. Drawing analogies. So here's my question. What do we as Christians, and as scientists, many of us, think about the concept of laws of nature? Do laws of nature proceed from the nature of God? And that's what they're driven by? Or are they simply something essentially arbitrary that God has created for the sake of the material universe, but that's all? They don't grow out of his self in any important sense. Or are the rules inherent in matter and energy? And if they are, how close do we get to them with our approximations, whether they be Newtonian, Einsteinian, quantum, or other? Do we ever actually get the laws of nature? Or are the laws of nature beyond our reach, but we have approximations that get close enough for the electricity to be fairly reliable? If there are laws, does God ever break them? And is that what miracles are? Or is that a complete misconception, simply based on the fact that we don't actually know the rules, we have what we think are the rules, and things that seem to break them we call miracles, but God's rules are actually a whole lot more complex, and they can cope with miracles as part of the system? That was the Augustinian view. And here's a question that I leave for a science that is not based on the idea of a Christian God, or a classically theistic general purpose God for that matter. Is science without God to make and enforce the laws of science actually on thin ice? Because you want to talk about laws, but you don't want there to be, well, you don't know what it is that made them or enforces them. So in what sense are they laws? Or is that just a misapplied metaphor? What I've been saying, in very brief, is that many, though not all, of the ideas that modern science is still struggling with about the ideas of the laws of nature has actually all been discussed before by the Greeks and Romans, who were fearfully clever people. And they didn't get it all right, but they do seem to have been asking the same questions we are. What do you think about the concept of laws of nature? And that's all from me, and now I believe we have time for questions.